starting this talk saying, and now for something completely different, because I thought it was going to be very different from the talk before it, but I actually think philosophically there are enormous similarities, and so I was very pleased to hear the talk that preceded this. So as you can guess, we're moving out of bacteria now, and we're talking about larger, more complicated animals, and we're going to return to topics of morphogenesis and patterning that came up on the first day and came up particularly in Hans Meinhardt's talk. But before I do that, I want to say the more broad thing about complex systems and biology in general as a motivation to the whole talk, and that's just to remind you that, you know, complex systems exist and networks exist everywhere in the physical and biological world, but in the physical world they arise spontaneously because of physical laws interacting with each other in interesting ways. And in biology, you have complex systems, or some would call these complicated systems, but they arise in addition for an entirely different reason, which is they arise because they do useful things. So they arise from natural selection, and this is just an example of the sort of network that controls a pattern in an early fruit fly embryo, and this actually actuates one of the things that Hans Meinhardt talked about yesterday, which is this local activation and long-range inhibition. So the consequences of that is that biology is full of devices that do jobs. Okay? And so to understand biology, you need not only understand mechanisms. Right? If you had a full mechanistic description of the physical world, you'd be done. But in biology, a mechanistic description is not enough. You also need to have, effectively, a teleological description. You have to say, what's this device for? What's its purpose? And that's one of the ways in which, in fact, this talk is much like the previous one. And also in which biology really, in my mind, is a lot more like engineering than physics. It's more about how you build stuff and make it work. And so that really flavors the way we approach biological problems. Okay, so let me turn your attention back to the idea of morphogens and morphogen gradients. Right? These are systems that are used in biology to specify pattern. These are some of the interesting kinds of patterns you can get in organisms. And fundamentally, at the molecular level, morphogens are just molecules that can move away from cells. And we actually know a lot these days about morphogens and what they bind to at mechanistic levels. We know quite a bit. We know most of the major morphogen families of animals, whether they're invertebrates or vertebrates, and most of them are polypeptides, but at least one of them is also a small chemical which diffuses and can go right through cell membranes. Now, when Hans Meinhardt talked, he spoke specifically about generation of sharp patterns out of complete randomness. Okay, and it was necessary to talk about how you could use positive feedback loops and long-range inhibitions to do that sort of thing. And that's one very specific example of pattern formation. But in many cases where morphogens are used, they're used for something that on the surface seems a lot simpler. You already have broken symmetry. You already know that something's over here. But now you need to elaborate this over a big field of cells and tell a whole bunch of cells, okay, you guys are at Cartesian coordinate 1, and you're at 2, and you're at 3, and you're at 4, and so on. And that's sort of the simplest thing that morphogens do. And the general theory of this is just that they're produced over here, and so they make a gradient because they get transported away. And cells sit at different spots in the gradient, and so some cells see a lot of morphogens, some see a little, and so they turn on different amounts of different genes, and that's enough to get the whole ball rolling to get them to differentiate, be different from each other. Okay, so there are a number of morphogen gradient systems that have been studied. Perhaps the best studied one at this point of this type of morphogen gradient system occurs in the fruit fly at a particular stage in the larva before it goes in to form a pupa. And it has little, so a larva is just a little worm, right? It doesn't actually have wings yet, but it has little disks of cells buried inside that are going to become wings. And they're essentially two-dimensional sheets, and they sort of look like this. And in the middle of the wing disc, a stripe of cells produces a morphogen called DPP, and that morphogen diffuses out in both directions. Okay, and as it diffuses out, it creates a gradient. Cells at different points in the gradient turn on different levels of genes, so some genes are turned on only in a zone here, and some here, and some not at all. Okay, And that seems to be fundamentally what this system is doing. Why does it turn on these stripes of gene expression? Well, a little bit later in development, at the boundaries between these stripes, other stripes of gene expression are turned on. And then a little bit later, as that goes into the pupa, and the fly goes into this little hibernation before it emerges with its wings, right, this thing pops out and expands, and these stripes are refined down to very thin stripes, which become the veins on the wings. And these aren't veins like your blood veins. These are sort of struts that make it possible for the wing to actually help the fly fly. Okay. Part of the reason this is a good system to look at the sort of network properties of morphogens is that we know a lot. So first of all, we can actually observe the morphogen itself by putting in fluorescently tagged forms of it and watching it move out. And we can do tricks to stain for, use antibodies to detect the actual signal that the cells are receiving from the morphogen. So we can see them both, we can make curves and divide them by each other. You know, so there's a lot of data out there. And most of this data really is out there. People have just been doing it and doing it. And somebody mentioned before there's 1,000 papers on sporulation. There's probably 5,000 papers on sort of the descriptive biology and the descriptive genetics of these sorts of things. And that's very useful. Okay, so what's the first question we can ask about this simple morphogen system? Well, we can ask the mechanistic question. What does it take to make a morphogen gradient? And that's a classical black box question, right? What goes in, morphogen, what comes out, gradient, so you want to know what's in the middle, right? Okay, so if you're a biochemist, and that's how I was first trained, you call every ligand L, so every morphogen's L. So you need a morphogen, and it needs to be produced, and so you call that V, because all rates, all productions are V, and it has to diffuse. And ordinarily, you think that would be all you need, but given the geometry in which this happens, it also has to be destroyed. If it doesn't, it'll just fill up, and you won't get a stable morphogen gradient. So if you have production, diffusion, destruction, you know, that makes a fairly simple differential equation, and you can solve it, and you can put in parameters and show, really, you can put in very reasonable parameters and get gradients that look an awfully lot like the real thing. Okay, so that shows that very simple processes can generate the gradient you need. Of course, that's a little bit too simple, since it's not the morphogen itself that cells sense. They actually sense the morphogen's binding to a receptor. So you better put the receptor in there, so it's got to be produced, and it's got to be degraded, or it will blow up. And you have to have some rate constants. And actually, the receptor is usually the thing that mediates the degradation of a polypeptide morphogen. And so, you know, differential equations get a little bit more complicated, but really not too ugly. And so you can again solve these. And now you begin to see some slightly interesting behavior. So for example, these two curves, random parameters here, but they differ only by twofold change in receptor synthesis. And you see what happens if you increase the number of receptors. You do get more morphogen signal here, but you get less morphogen signal there. Why? Because signaling and destruction are coupled to each other. More receptors means more morphogen binds here, but less gets to there, because more of it gets destroyed over there. And that's actually very comforting, because when you look at the real data in the biological system, that's exactly what you see. So here's, again, a published experiment showing this is where DPP is produced. It diffuses out this way and this way. And now you've tricked this fly by putting in way too much receptor, and the gradient is pulled back and gets brighter in the middle, which is exactly what this green curve would tell you. So that says, okay, you know, maybe the simple model is not too far off. Of course, if you want to be accurate, you'll recognize that it's not actually the ligand receptor complex on the cell surface that gets degraded. It's got to go into the cell first and then get degraded. So there's another step, another couple of equations, but really it behaves pretty much the same way. Okay. So now we know the minimum you would need to make a plausible morphogen gradient that has the right shape in the right tissue. Now we can compare this with the actual mechanisms that you find in the animal. So the first thing you see is it's well known that there's a feedback loop whereby the amount of signaling, which is here represented by the amount of morphogen receptor complexes, it's not clear whether being out or in really matters, so we'll make the arrow from both, signaling feeding back on the production of receptors. In addition, it turns out receptors aren't the only thing on the cell surface that bind the morphogen. The other stuff I'll be vague about, and I'll just call it non-receptors, because it isn't receptors, but we can talk later about what it actually is. But anyway, these are other molecules that bind morphogen, and they go in and they degrade, and they also have to be synthesized and degraded. So then it turns out that the non-receptors are not constitutively made. They too are the subject of negative feedback by the morphogen signaling. So then it turns out that some of the non-receptors are actually what we call co-receptors, which means that the amount of signal that comes out of here, or perhaps the amount of complex formation here, is somehow subtly controlled by the amount of this stuff over here. Okay, and there's various mechanisms that have been proposed and some of them well tested for co-reception. And then actually, if you look closely in the system, there isn't just one morphogen. There's actually another one called GBB, which is expressed in a somewhat different distribution, but seems to interact with all the same components and do all the same things. So when I get to this point and I show it to a biology audience, I always get the same reaction. Unfortunately, this audience is much more sophisticated. Anyway, it turns out this sort of complexity is not just the DPP gradient. In fact, the DPP gradient is the simplest one I know of. All of the others are worse, right? So in every case, the receptors are under feedback control. In every case, there are non-receptors. In every case, there are co-receptors. In every case, there are more than one type of receptor and more than one type of morphogen. Some morphogens are modified in ways that would presumably make them diffuse slower. There are inhibitors all over the place. There are proteases that cleave inhibitors. There are hydrolases that cleave co-receptors. And even as was suggested yesterday, some belief that there's actually alternate transport mechanisms beside diffusion that play a role. So this begs the teleological question, why? Why would you do this? So some in the biology world like to answer this question with Goldberg's conjecture. So I don't know if any of you know about Rube Goldberg's cartoons. He used to draw these lovely little machines that would do very simple things, like this is the self-opening umbrella, and there's about 10 different steps here to get the umbrella to open when the rain hits the sponge. A lot of biologists are fond of saying, oh, it's biology, it's ugly, it's messy, you know, it doesn't have to make sense. I don't believe that, particularly when you're looking at system architectures that have been around for 100 million years or more unchanged. It's kind of telling you that it's not just a random mess. And so I prefer Sullivan's Law. So this is Lewis Sullivan. He was an architect, famous architect, credited with inventing the skyscraper. But actually what he'll be longest remembered for is saying this thing, form follows function. Every architecture and design student learns this. What they don't learn is he was actually talking about biology when he said it. He was referring to the biological world that it was so obvious that things were built in order to do a good job at particular functions. Okay, and so if you could look at how they're built, you could understand something about what they were doing. In the language of engineering, we'd say in systems that are designed to do things, the architecture of the system ought to reflect the performance objectives of the system. And again, we heard a lot of that in the previous talk, which will be happening.
Does this law imply that whatever form that you've designed, is it optimal form? Or is it
I knew the O word would come in. So biologists like to argue about whether things are optimal or not. And so I like to back away from that debate and just say, when I'm studying an architecture that's been around for 500 million years, and I guess that it's somewhat in the direction of optimality, I'll probably be right. And occasionally, maybe I'll be wrong, but I'll be right a whole lot more than I'll be wrong. So that as a heuristic tool in approaching problems, to assume that a complex architecture is there for a reason is probably not a bad idea. And that's really all I need to say, right? I don't need to say that every system that's there is there because it's been optimized for some purpose.
So you're saying, or what Sullivan's saying, that since form follows function, that when the giraffe got its long neck, it got it because it needed it?
No. We're not talking about how things got. Presumably evolution is the reason things got the way they are, and that involves natural selection. But I'm not really talking about the mechanism by which form becomes related to function, but simply saying as a tool for understanding the world, right, to try to understand the biological world, ignoring the fact that the structure of things in the biological world is related to the purpose of the job or to the job things are doing, is to really take a very, very limited view of biology, and it's really to keep you from understanding a lot.
So people might have asked you this, so what is the function of a male nipple?
We'll come back to that later. I think male nipples is something to talk about after beer. Okay.
Well, let me just say that nipples in general start to have a sweat gland.
Yes, that's right.
But
that doesn't explain that question.
But doesn't explain.
I wasn't explaining.
Yes.
The more important thing here than nipples is your, you're talking about structure and function.
Correct.
In any kind of material science program there, you talk about composition, structure, properties.
Right, but this is different. I'm not talking about structure and properties.
But are you not putting properties in any?
No. Well, obviously properties are important.
Yeah, but are you going to put this into that?
Of course. Of course.
So
of
what
course.
Is the property of the material that is performance action?
Correct. So I'm not saying one should reject mechanism.
These are the things that I'm talking about too.
Right. So in other words, what I'm saying is mechanism is a level of understanding, but you must also, in biology, be thinking about purposes of things. Otherwise, you have a very dim, limited view of biology.
Well, you define the function.
I prefer purpose because function has two meanings in biology. Most practicing molecular biologists define function operational. In terms of the way a system crashes when you remove something, that's its function. That's obviously very self-consistent, so you never go wrong with it, but it tends to lead you away from what you want to know, which was, why did it evolve to be that way? And those type of experimental definitions of function don't take you there. So that's really what a lot of what my talk is about. How do you get there? How do you begin to understand why things are the way they are? Okay. We can come back to the philosophy later. It's fun, but there's other things.
Actually, this isn't philosophy of design.
Okay. The philosophy is the approach, how one approaches the science. I mean, I'd love to talk about it for hours, but let's talk about the rest of it, and then we'll come back to it. Okay. So essentially, all I've said is simply that from this standpoint, the fact that we have these morphogenic gradient systems with all this complexity just means they have performance objectives that you haven't thought of. Okay? And that's really the reason for thinking this way, is to get you to think, what else might this system be doing that you haven't thought of? Okay. So I like to call this a white box problem to distinguish it from the black box problem, because it is not in any way a black box problem. The assumption is you know all the mechanistic detail inside the box, and you're trying to figure out what job this does. Is this a toaster oven? Is this a microwave? Is this a laptop computer? Right from that. So it's related to what many people would call reverse engineering. Okay, so now let's get to the details. What additional performance objectives should we think about in morphogenic gradient systems? So the first one an engineer will think about is robustness, right? Because biology is very robust, and in fact, developmental biology is astonishingly robust. You can really do nasty things to embryos and have them come right back. Let's talk about one particular type of robustness called insensitivity to parametric uncertainty. That is, the parameters might not be what they ought to be. And the reason why we can talk about that is we know experimentally from the fact that you have two copies of every gene, and usually you can lose one of them, and it doesn't make a big difference. It's not true for all your genes, but maybe about 95% of them. And that goes even for genes involved in pattern formation. And that's actually quite a deep thing, that you can lose half, the capacity to make half of something and pretty much come out with the right pattern. Okay, so if we go back to this little simple toy system here that makes a good gradient, right? Now we just ask, how much does it change if I vary this number, the production of morphogen, twofold, representing a change in gene dosage of that. Okay, and so these are twofold pairs for two particular random parameter sets. And you can see it's pretty ugly, right? These are big shifts in morphogen gradients. This would be like your arm would be down here at your hip instead of up here, right? So you don't want this. You want something more robust than that. Okay, so how do we get at this problem? First, we've got to quantify what we mean by robustness. When you're talking about a scalar parameter, that's easy, but when you're talking about a curve, you have to have some metric. So we have a metric that basically just quantifies the average distance between these curves. And then we can do this about 100,000 to a million times, picking random parameter sets and explore the whole parameter space and ask how robust is every point in parameter space, and then spread it out according to some internal parameter. A useful one is how saturated the receptors are at the start of the gradient. You can see this cloud of points and this value, this fragility value, how non-robust it is, never gets below 0.43, which roughly means that gradient shifts about 43% to the right or left. Okay. So that's not very robust. This is 0.43 here. It's not too satisfying. Interestingly, if we just put in the first little piece of complexity, which is that there's extra stuff that the morphogen binds to and gets degraded by, so a few more ODEs, do this experiment again, now it's easy to find cases that are very robust. So again, you can explore the whole parameter space.
So why?
Well, I'm getting there. so you need to explore the parameter space first to find out why. So what you find out is the cases that are robust are all down here, so they involve a high level of receptor saturation, and also a lot of the degradation of morphogens is going through the receptor, is going through the non-receptors instead of the receptor. Okay, and under those three conditions, you can go back to your insoluble ODEs and reduce them to a form where you can basically solve and show in this asymptotic case that you get a very low, you can get as robust as you like. Okay. So then we can move on. We say, okay, what about this little feedback loop?
So why? Why did that help?
You want it, okay. So can I do it with the feedback one? It's a little easier there. But we can go over it later. Okay. So if we do, so we for just for this feedback effect, we just do a hyperbolic inhibition with lots of parameters in here, so we can have basically any shape of feedback we want with floor or ceiling that we like. And then we find a sort of counter to what your initial thought might be, you know, negative feedback is a good thing for robustness, right? We actually find it's not. Okay, that basically when you have this negative feedback, that there are no more cases below this threshold and there are more cases above it. And the reason for that is because fiddling around with receptor number has this biphasic effect. Close to the morphogen source, more receptors means more signal, but away from it, more receptors means less signal. So anything that feeds back on receptor number has opposite effects in different parts of the gradient, and that tends to cancel out. You tend not to get any big improvement by using that feedback strategy. And yet, if you take the feedback strategy and pile it on top of the non-receptor strategy, now suddenly you get all these robust cases out here. Okay, and the reason for this one, which is a little easier to explain, is because now when you have a lot of degradative flux going through the non-receptors, you've broken the connection that forces, that connects more signaling to more degradation. Those are no longer linked to each other, and so you're able to use negative feedback in the way that engineers like to use negative feedback to actually decrease sensitivity and make things more robust to parameter change. Okay, and there's just an example of one of these cases here, and they operate when receptors are not very saturated, so we have a very linear response. But of course, this is just playing around with one parameter. There's other parameters there, and particularly the ones that you can vary genetically are things like production rates. You can take away a copy of receptor gene. And so we can do this two parameters at a time. You can see in the simple model, things that get fragile for one thing get fragile for the other. This is robustness to morphogen synthesis and receptor synthesis. And when we put on that feedback on receptors, it doesn't get better. When we put back that the presence of non-receptors, now you see that the things that become robust to morphogen levels are way over on the right side on this axis, meaning they become very fragile to receptor levels. So you've traded off one for the other. On the other hand, if you use this feedback strategy on top of non-receptors, now you get this little tongue of green cases pointing to 0, 0. That's a good thing. That means becoming robust to one makes you robust to the other. Okay. Now you put in the feedback on the non-receptors, nothing happens. It looks the same. So that makes you think, uh-oh, we're still missing some performance objectives here. And you think, okay, well, basically we've solved our problem. We can be robust to these two rates. But of course, to be robust, you need non-receptors, and that brings in another rate, right? There's another gene we could be heterozygous, that is, missing one copy of. So now you have to make a three-dimensional plot. I don't know how to do that in PowerPoint. So instead, I'm just going to take this axis here and put that over here. And over here, I'm putting the fragility to the non-receptor synthesis. And you can see all the points that are good for these two axes are bad for that axis. Essentially, again, a complete robustness trade-off. So we can build these little strategies to be robust to one thing or another, and we're always paying the price in lost robustness to a different thing. Until we put the co-receptors in. So So remember I told you about this little thing here where you have an effect of these on the assembly or signaling of this. And we code this in various ways, but it actually doesn't matter as long as it has this general property. Then you get a bunch of new cases down here, and when you analyze them, their robustness to non-receptors is way down here. So they're reasonably robust to all three things at once. And actually, if you then go back to the biology and you say, does this make sense that co-receptors are there to make gradients more robust? It actually does turn out to fit the data in the sense that this is a co-receptor, and so as we're moving in this direction, we're taking away copies of it. This is the receptor, and as we're moving in this direction, we're lowering its dosage as well. Okay, and so as we go in this direction, we're looking at the robustness to fluctuating receptor levels, and we're seeing that when you remove the co-receptor, these changes are much bigger on a proportional scale than these changes. So in fact, the system is actually a lot more fragile when you don't have the co-receptor around. Okay. Of course, even with co-receptors, there's no system that falls out of these parameters that's perfectly robust to everything. And of course, that's not necessarily what the organism wants. The organism wants to be robust to whatever evolution has selected it to be robust for. And so even, or robust to. So even though we use genetic alterations to probe robustness, that's probably not the important thing. Environmental fluctuations, perturbations are much more important in that they happen much more frequently and they affect the entire community as opposed to the very rare individual. And in fact, just so you know how big this problem is, these are the ranges of temperature over which a Drosophila, a fruit fly, can grow. And this is the rate of protein synthesis, just overall protein synthesis over that temperature range. It's a threefold change. So these are big perturbations between noon and 4 in the afternoon that, you know, any fly is going to be exposed to out in the wild. So we actually have some preliminary evidence that using the co-reception amplification of the feedback and non-receptor-based strategies that we can actually get pretty decent robustness to some guesses as to what a temperature perturbation would be. But it's actually very hard to pin down what temperature perturbations really are at the level of the biochemistry. Okay, let me move on to another thing, because robustness is something that engineers talk about a lot, and it's not surprising to think that that would be an important performance objective of any biological system. So I want to talk about some of the others that you might not think. One of these has to do with this issue of timing. And to talk about timing, I need to introduce another morphogen gradient. But lucky for you, it's the same morphogen. It's this molecule DPP. But the geometry is very different to this system. So the early fly embryo is kind of like a cigar in shape. And this is a cross-section through that cigar. And it has a top or a dorsal surface and a bottom or a ventral surface. And up at the top, the morphogen is made over pretty much half the fly. This is a side view, so you can see. Half the fly makes the morphogen. And it patterns that top half of the fly in a process that requires at least three other genes, called SOG, toloid, and twisted gastrulation. Okay, SOG is made down at the bottom part of the fly, and it's an inhibitor of DPP. It inhibits it physically by binding it and preventing it from binding its receptors. Toloid is a protease, an enzyme, that cleaves and destroys SOG. Specifically does so when it's bound to DPP. And twisted gastrulation is a protein that helps SOG and DPP bind each other. Okay? So it's a complicated system. And it has a complicated output. Early on, so now we're looking down at the top, and this green staining is the actual signal that's coming from occupied morphogen receptors. Early on, these occupied morphogen receptors pretty much occupy a domain that's roughly up here. And then, rather abruptly in this early phase of embryogenesis, that looks like it sort of shrinks in and gets really, really strong in this stripe right down the middle. Okay? All right. And then that stripe formation specifies where a particular structure is going to form in the fly, which is then important for its further development. Okay, how can we take this apart? Let's first, since it's symmetrical, we'll split it down the middle, we'll rotate it this way and flatten it out. And we'll have something like this, where DPP is produced here and SOG is produced there. Since they're both diffusible molecules, you might expect DPP would diffuse that way, SOG will diffuse this way, and since DPP and SOG bind each other and SOG prevents DPP from binding its receptor, you'd get a free DPP profile, something like this. And so it's not surprising that the domain of which where DPP is signaling is smaller than the domain where it's produced. But what about that later step where it gets really strong here? You can show if you don't have SOG, that never happens. It stays flat and low. So SOG is doing something important, and it was proposed almost 10 years ago by Chick Ferguson that what goes on is that SOG binds DPP, diffuses, gets degraded, releases DPP. Another SOG comes along, binds DPP, diffuses, gets degraded, releases DPP. Since SOG is getting degraded, it's net diffusing in this direction, and the net result is DPP has pushed up its own concentration gradient to form a peak in the middle. So it took about 8 years for Nama Barkai's group to come around and prove mathematically that that strategy actually does work. It's a few PDEs to show it. They did a very lovely job of showing that this, what they call SOG shuttle, or facilitated transport, can really move a morphogen back into its own expression domain. But interestingly, when they published it, what they really paid most attention to in their paper was that the system they wrote produced an extremely robust pattern. That is to say, there was a sharp peak in, activity in the middle. This is the midline looking down at the top, right? And if you took away one copy of just about anything in the system except DPP itself, the peaks never changed, or they changed very little. So they said, wow, this is not only a shuttle, but the shuttle's there to be extremely robust. And there were two problems with that interpretation. Number one, it's simply wrong. It's not what the biology does. If you actually look at animals that are missing one copy of SOG or have an extra copy, this peak in the middle gets wider or skinnier, depending upon how much SOG you put in. So it's not robust at all. And second of all, there are a number of assumptions in here that were, say, not terribly biological, like the DPP came on for 10 minutes and then disappeared so that the system could relax to steady state, or that DPP didn't diffuse, or other things like that. So we went back and reformulated basically a very similar system, but taking away all the biologically problematic assumptions. And of course you get a system that isn't robust, but that's okay, the organism's not robust. But it has some very interesting properties. It forms that peak in the middle because it still has this SOG shuttle, but it forms it rather abruptly. So up till 15 minutes you don't see much of anything, and then suddenly, boop, up comes this peak and then grows very quickly. It turns out that that dynamics doesn't really require any of the diffusion. You can build a simpler system of this with all the diffusion terms left out, and it shows the same behavior, that the concentration of free DPP or DPP bound to receptors stays very low and then abruptly grows. Okay? And the reason for it is actually very simple. SOG is only cleaved when it's bound to DPP. Initially, SOG is produced at a fast rate, DPP is produced at a fast rate, but lots more SOG is made than DPP, so DPP stays buffered, right? But then as SOG starts getting cleaved, DPP is getting released, so the net rate of DPP coming into the system is actually going up, the net rate SOG is going down, eventually you break the point where you're buffering, and up you go, all the SOG's getting destroyed and the DPP's not. It's essentially a chain reaction. And so, interesting, it creates a timer. It's a little clock mechanism at 20 minutes to shoot this peak up. Okay. And actually, when you know about these timing effects, you can explain some biological data that otherwise made no sense. So, for example, if you take away one copy of DPP from this gradient, the gradient goes down. If you take away a copy of SOG, the gradient goes down. But if you take away both DPP and SOG, the gradient is actually up again. Okay. And that seemed really paradoxical. But actually makes sense, because when you take away the copy of SOG, well, I have to say, this is not a steady state, right? This is 35 minutes on the way to a steady state. And at this point, that when you take away SOG, the peak jump has happened sooner, and so it's progressed farther. Eventually, it will settle down to be below the others. Okay. Was that clear? Okay. Good. Let me talk about some other performance objectives. Again, sort of in the order of which biologists tend not to think about them. Noise suppression. We've heard a lot about noise in this meeting in many different ways, and I just want to underscore the fact that it's really looking like the noisiness of gene expression in both prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells is rather massive. I mean, cells in a free living state seem to have enormous variance on the level of expression of their genes. And if you have a morphogen and gradient system like this, which is supposed to say, okay, right here, build this, and you have noisy gene expression, it's not a good thing, right, for, say, the receptors or the signaling pathway if it's noisy. And this is only showing you 25% noise, and probably the intrinsic noise of eukaryotic cells is on the order of 4 or 5-fold differences among cells. At least that's what cell culture experiments would lead one to believe. Okay. So first you...
So does that suggest that just varying parameters by factors of 2 is not the best idea?
Not the best what?
Well, so in your studies, you were looking at varying parameters by factors of 2, right?
Okay, so...
In the robustness plot.
This is a theoretical argument. This is saying if you had this level of noise and it persisted in a gradient, it would be a bad thing. But in fact, somehow this noise is obviously suppressed because you can measure gene expression in vivo in a gradient, and it's not like this at all. Okay, so in reality, noise is presumably being suppressed, okay, in vivo. The question is this something that the organism has to work hard to do? Because other data seem to suggest that intrinsically gene expression is very noisy. So, good question. So at first you might think, you know, we've got a bunch of negative feedback loops in here. Negative feedback loops are good for suppressing noise. In fact, there's some other negative feedback loops I haven't even told you about that operate inside the cell. But of course, negative feedback on its own is not a good way to suppress noise because you'd suppress signal as much as noise if you just have a simple negative feedback loop. So you really need to have some technique of distinguishing noise from signal. And of course, it was already mentioned, you could filter based on frequency. But it turns out that most of the data on gene expression noise suggests it's pretty slowly varying on the order of the cell cycle, which would be on the order of half a day. This whole morphogenetic process only takes 2-3 days. So it would be hard to really, really accurately filter based on temporal frequency alone. But on the other hand, if the noise is arising due to fluctuations from cell to cell, right, each cell has a different level of noise in its gene expression, that should lead to a lot of spatial discontinuities, and that would be something you could theoretically use to suppress noise. Essentially, if you had some spatial frequency filtering, you could suppress noise and not suppress the signal. Okay, and so is there evidence that cells in these sorts of morphogen gradients do spatial frequency, at least sensing, right? Are they sensing discrepancies? And a few years ago, Michael Connor's group showed that if you tricked a cell into getting a signal higher or lower than the cells around it, even though the gradient was normal, that a set of processes would ensue that would eventually cause that cell and all of its neighbors to drop dead. Okay, and so he envisioned this as a way to repair really bad damage. Okay, maybe that could repair really bad damage, but it's not a good strategy to deal with small disparities, right? The whole wing would end up dead, right? You need something a little subtler than that. And more recently, Ken Irvine's lab did similar experiments, but looked in a more transient period, looked in the first 12 hours. And so these little green spots are areas where the cells have been tricked into having too much signal, sitting in the midst of a morphogen gradient. So they create sharp discrepancies with their neighbors. And what you can see from these red dots is a signaling pathway, that is, a whole set of genes has been turned on, not just in the cells that are doing the wrong thing, but they're being turned on at the boundaries, and cells on both sides of the boundary are turning on the same pathway. And they turn it on transiently, only for about 12 hours, only about the length of one cell cycle, okay, which is, remember, is about the characteristic time that we think the noise is operating at. So if nothing else, this tells us that cells in this gradient are not just sitting there responding to the level of the morphogen, they're also responding to the spatial derivative and the temporal derivative at that level. And that's something that we tend not to think of. They're extracting a lot more information out of this gradient than we used to give them credit to. Okay. So this just tells you that... Question?
So do you know how they do this spatial sensing? Is it an autocrine mechanism? Some way that...
Well, clearly about cell communication. This question might best be deferred to tomorrow's talk about the planar cell polarity pathway, which is another example of cell communication and sensing differences from one cell to another as an example. But basically, we don't know what the mechanism is. We have some guesses. Okay. So this just tells us that, yes, it's plausible. If there were noise, cells could sense it. But can we actually find a morphogen system in which we can show that there is noise and or evidence that there is noise and that cells are suppressing it? We think so. And this is in the pupil wing vein. So yet another morphogen gradient system, lucky for you, also involves DPP. Okay, but we'll get to that. So remember, these stripes in the wing disc ultimately tell you where you're going to make these thin veins, right? And they do that by going through a stage when at first they make fat proveins. And those proveins are places where DPP is made. And then between them, this other gene, SOG, turns on. Remember SOG? SOG was that inhibitor that showed up in the embryo. And if you take this and slice this, like, you know, sort of, it looks just like an embryo filleted out, right? You have DPP down the middle and SOG on both sides. And in fact, all the same kinds of molecules, the protease that cleaves SOG and the thing that helps DPP load onto, they're all there. And so what this is telling you is this is the same kind of system that's pushing DPP towards the middle of some domain and helping DPP specify a thin vein down the middle of the thick domain where it's being produced. Okay, so it looks like the same motif has been utilized again, right? The question is why? In the embryo, if you take away the SOG shuttle, you never get this peak in the middle. But in a wing vein, you do. If you take away SOG, you still get a vein. Or if you take away this other guy, which helps load things onto the SOG, you still get a vein. But notice the veins are crooked. They're not straight veins. Okay. So why do you get veins at all? So first of all, you get veins at all because there's a positive feedback, actually an autoactivation long-range inhibition system, so that if you get a peak here at all, the peak gets refined to a sharp spike, whether or not you have SOG, right? Without SOG, you would expect you wouldn't have such a sharp peak because you're not shoveling DPP into the middle. But positive feedback gives you a sharp vein no matter what. Okay, so then why the phenotype? Well, think about the noise in the system. If this is the profile you have, and we add some noise to that profile, it's not going to pick the right place to put the vein, right, depending on the noise. But if we have this profile and we put the same noise on it, it's going to get it right each time. Okay, so in one case you get a vein that wanders, and in the other case you get a vein that goes straight. Yeah.
Do they not fly as well if the veins are crooked? What happens to them?
I bet as a population effect, you would probably see it. But on the individual fly, I don't think you could tell.
So I think you said this yesterday, but does the DPP set up the background so that the vein can grow? Or does it set up the cells to be appropriate for, you know, the vein passing through? Or
right. It sets up the cell identity so that they become vein cells. And then they produce a series of gene products which makes them different, and they actually become stiff and attached. Right. Okay, anyway, one of the reasons why it's interesting to call attention to this system in which a SOG shuttle is combined with a self-refining feedback system is actually, if you go back to that early embryo where I just told you about the SOG shuttle, it turns out the self-refining feedback system's there too. It just hadn't been noticed. And very recently it was shown that there is a similar effect that pushes this thing up and refines it no matter what it originally started at. And so that suggests we actually have an ancestral system of two coupled processes, one involving facilitated transport and one involving self-enhancement and lateral inhibition that ultimately give you something that's both in the right place and straight. Okay. So and the reason you need it to be straight is because of the noise in the system. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is something, I don't know a good name for this, but I would call this morphogen collaboration. And just this is just to show you that I don't only care about flies, I care about other animals too. And this is the zebrafish embryo, and you heard a little bit about this on the first day, about amphibian embryos and fish embryos. They start as one cell, which splits to two, makes lots of cells, makes this sort of shield or covering of cells, which then moves down and curls in the process of gastrulation, and cells move that way, and it's very complicated to explain all the movements. But the important thing is to know that even at this stage, all the cells can be represented on a fate map. In other words, we know where various structures are going to come from. And we have axes. We have a dorsal-ventral axis. And we have an anterior to posterior axis, although some of the posterior cells are going to be located here. As you recall, Hans Meinhardt mentioned that they have to move up this way. Okay, so we have axes there. And the cells along those, you don't merely have to set up axes, but you also have to tell the cells along the axes what to become. During as early as gastrulation, when it's still just a ball, basically, you're already turning on patterns of gene expression among these cells that tell you which part of the brain, this is the hindbrain, so the medulla and those parts, which part of the brain these cells are going to become. This is already turning on this early when you have these cells kind of curling under and moving up the underside of the embryo in that direction. You can see the black, these are the genes being turned on. The red is just sort of a marker of location. So you can see where everything is next to the same general reference point. Okay, and these are different genes involved in turning on different fates. Okay. Well, if you thought DPP was complicated, in the zebrafish embryo, there's at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 morphogen gradient systems operating at the same time. Four of them have very similar expression patterns. Four of them involve proteins, and one of them involves a small molecule, retinoic acid, or RA. I'm going to talk about these two, FGF, fibroblast growth factors, and RA, because they're both involved in the same process, and that is posteriorizing the hindbrain. What that means is conferring posterior identities as opposed to anterior identities, which the cells would take on without signals. Without either FGF or RA, those cells become too anterior, and if you have too much FGF-RA, they become too posterior. Interestingly, the effects of FGF require RA, but the effects of RA don't require FGF, so that suggests FGF is in some way working through RA. And oddly, if you have no RA in the embryo, but just dump it in the water, in the tank, embryos are rescued. The pattern is normal. So that's kind of weird, because a lot of other experiments suggest RA is acting in a gradient from a source, and yet somehow you can apply it everywhere, and it seems to be doing the same job. Okay. FGF and RA are both produced in the same place, the sort of posterior end of the gastrula. Okay. And they seem to do the same thing. So the question is why? Why are they both working together? And to understand that, it helps to know that this little molecule here, CYP26A1, is the thing that degrades RA. So RA is a small molecule. It's not degraded by its receptors. It doesn't get degraded until it hits an enzyme that oxidizes it. Okay? And that's located in a very big patch here at the anterior end. So RA is going from here to here. And presumably you have a source-sink relationship, right? Those are the simplest gradients. But then you have these interesting properties that FGF inhibits the expression of this gene, and RA inhibits FGF's inhibition of the expression of this gene. So you have these two inhibitory effects on the thing that seems to be involved in controlling the RA gradient. Okay, so, I mean, actually, you can model this now in a fairly phenomenological way by just, you know, having a diffusion equation for RA in which you have a degradation term that's modified by something that depends on the FGF gradient, and the FGF gradient strength is modified by something that depends on RA, and so you can solve this numerically. And you get some interesting things just from looking at, you know, in a fairly parameter-independent way, what sort of behaviors come out of this sort of system. So one of them is that the RA and the FGF gradients are now coupled to each other. If you fiddle with the FGF gradient, move it about, up and down by changing its parameters, the RA gradient tends to move with it. Okay, show that one more time. Okay, to a large extent, that's because FGF is really setting where the RA sink is. Why might that be important? Well, if you remember, in the course of gastrulation, the domain that's being patterned actually grows about threefold. So the FGF gradient is constantly changing in order to span a much larger distance. So this is an automatic way to make the RA gradient pretty much match whatever the FGF gradient is doing. Okay, what else falls out of this? Well, the other thing is, if you vary the RA synthesis rate, the gradient shifts, but not nearly as much as if it were a linear gradient going from source to sink. And that's because RA is inducing its own degradation by inhibiting the ability of FGF to inhibit its degrader. And so because of RA's own induction of its own degradation, when you have more RA, it gets degraded faster, which is a homeostatic negative feedback loop. And so you actually get a certain amount of robustness. And that's not a bad idea, because RA being synthesized from a dietary vitamin would be expected to have an enormous amount of uncertainty in how much you're making. There's actually not great controls on making of RA. But there's another interesting thing that comes out of this, And that is if you take all the endogenous RA out and then just dump RA everywhere, so model this as a certain amount of RA coming in at every position, you still get a gradient, and it's really not that bad compared to the gradients that you're getting by the system itself. So it also shows, and this is just showing a twofold range in the amount of RA that you add, so it also shows this property of it doesn't matter where the RA is, it can still, over the right range of parameters at least, it can still pattern the hindbrain. So this tells us that the RA gradient is relatively robust because of its effect on its own degradation, and it follows the FGF gradient because FGF's setting where its major degradation is over here, and you can get it to be formed reasonably well even if the RA is coming from everywhere. But it still begs the teleological question. If you're doing all this work to make the RA gradient follow the FGF gradient and deal with its own problems of not being robust, I mean, why not just dispense with the RA gradient and use the FGF gradient, which is coming from the same place, to pattern the same system? So for that, we don't have an answer, but we have what we think is a pretty good speculation. And that is, if you look at those genes that are directly turned on by FGF, and there are some, and you look at their patterns of expression, you see remarkably fuzzy borders. Whereas if you look at those things that are turned on through RA, you see remarkably sharp borders. And actually, interesting, Michelle Kirsberg had a paper 10 years ago about the RA system saying, you know, there's something special about the system because there's all of this cooperativity and positive feedback and the signaling itself, it's extremely well suited to making ultra-sensitive or to driving ultra-sensitive behaviors where you have sharp borders. And he actually did some simulations to show there's something intrinsically good about RA for making sharp borders, but there's something intrinsically bad about RA for making robust gradients. So it seems like we have a case of a system that's more easily controlled, FGF, driving a system that does the job of sharp borders a lot better. At least that's our current hypothesis. Okay. Let me just sum up. I think I've hopefully convinced you that even simple morphogen gradients, when you look at the mechanisms underlying them, they look like complicated machines. And it is logical, I should say it is useful, to assume that a complicated system architecture actually is there for a reason, it serves a purpose. And we can debate all we want whether occasionally I will get burned by that assumption, but the point is a lot of good work could get done before that happened. Okay. Biologists, therefore, are probably missing a lot of the major performance objectives of morphogen gradient systems, and we need ways systematically to identify what those performance objectives are. And I would submit that computational exploration, that is, can help address the white box problem. In other words, we're not trying to build any validatable model here. We're not trying to create a model to match some set of data, many sets of data. We're simply trying to say the model is specified by what the biologist says is going on in terms of the individual mechanistic action interactions. We're trying to explore what those interactions are capable of. And in that sense, it's more of a hypothesis generator than a prediction generator. I should say the reason why I think this is an important approach is because the landscape of biology has really been changing a lot lately. 20 years ago, this was biology's closet, full of black boxes, right? We knew lots of things that organisms did, right? And not a lot about the mechanisms underlying them. Well, maybe this is a little optimistic, the number of white boxes here. But the point is, the whiteness content of our closet is going up dramatically. We're having huge amounts of data, very precise mechanistic data, even if we don't have parameter values. That's probably the last thing biologists kicking and screaming will go and measure is parameter values, but even without them, right, there's a lot you can learn about the structure of an architecture by exploring it. And so I would say this is going to become increasingly important in systems biology. Okay, robustness is likely to be an important performance objective of morphogen gradients, but is always going to be subject to trade-offs. Engineers know this in their blood, right? Biologists need to remember this. We also need to remember that the perturbations that actually drove system architecture are going to be the environmental ones and not the genetic ones. The genetic ones are just the tools that we use to exploit them. And the ability to mitigate robustness trade-offs defines a potential purpose for co-receptors. which is actually a big open question in biology. Why in the world you'd ever make co-receptors in the first place? They seem to do nothing useful, right? They just modulate the gain on a system that you could just modulate the gain on by having more ligands or more receptors or a stronger signaling pathway. Why do you need a separate class of molecules? Anyway, the computation suggests at least one possible reason for that. And finally, that robustness is one performance objective to pay attention to, but it's probably just the tip of the iceberg, and that we also need to think about the control of timing. Probably only very few morphogen gradients operate in the steady state. Suppression of noise, and I only talked about a small piece of the noise suppression that probably needs to go on. Coordination among gradients, and coordinating pattern with growth, which is another whole area I didn't get to talk about, but is very important. Finally, let me just acknowledge very critical collaborators in this work. Qing Ni has just been absolutely essential and fantastic as a colleague to make it possible to have both a lot of biology and a lot of mathematics and a lot of computation in this work. Fred Wan also has been extremely helpful with the math. Yang Tao Zhang, another mathematician from UCI who's been involved in many of the projects I talked about. These are students in my lab who've been involved a little more on the experimental side of this, and much of this has been a collaboration with three fly biologists and one zebrafish biologist who have generously gone off and done crazy experiments when we ask them to.